It seems like there are 1,000 editions of the board game Monopoly available, but there's a new one coming out this fall called Monopoly Cheaters Edition. It's like normal Monopoly, but now the goal is to get away with cheating. The VP of Hasbro said, "A recent study conducted by Hasbro reveals that nearly half of game players attempt to cheat during Monopoly games. So in 2018, we decided it was time to give fans what they've been craving all along, a Monopoly game that actually encourages cheating." I think this rings true in my home growing up. I played with my sister. She didn't cheat. I always did. And so I always won. So 50% of people cheat. That was true in our family. But it's about time I finally admit it, that I am a Monopoly cheater. I like winning, and the only way to win is to cheat at Monopoly. So half the people cheat, but they won't admit it. And if caught, they will deny it. And so it's hard to admit when you're wrong or when you're caught, right? When you've made a mistake, you've done something wrong, when you've cheated, when you've gone down the wrong path, it's hard to admit it because it means you have to come to a place of humility and to honestly assess your situation. It's easier to live in denial. It's easier to keep the charade going. It's easier to deny it than it is to admit we were wrong and we need to change. People would rather say things like, "I live my life with no regrets." Really? Like so proud that you would take nothing back if you went back. You've learned nothing. You will take nothing back. Deep offenses you've committed, wrongs you've done, mistakes that you've made. And no, I'm doubling down on them. No regrets. I may be wrong, but I'm going to arrogantly be wrong and refuse to change. Because change is hard. Repentance is hard. Turning, returning is hard. It's really hard. When we left Naomi, she was in a really tough position at the end of last week. Right? Life is painful and bitter for her. And some of this is because of her husband's fault in leading them away from Israel. Some of it is her own poor decisions. And much of it is things that no one chooses, painful events that happen to her that are entirely out of her control. And yet, we also see that God is pursuing her all the way to the fields of Moab. And when we left Naomi, we left wondering, would she ever return? Right? Would she be able to change? Would she be able to come back? Because returning is so hard. And here's how it opens, verse 6. "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food." Now, at first read, we might go, hey, Naomi kind of finally came to her senses and made a good decision to return. And in a sense, that's true. But if we look closely, we also see that by the time Naomi chooses to return, God has been actively and graciously at work drawing her home. Right? In the book of Ruth, the text never comes out and says, God did it. Look at him. He's doing this. But instead, the way the author's telling the story, the way the narrator lays it out for us, we keep coming across these coincidences and these things just seem to happen. And isn't that interesting? And they happen upon this and by coincidences. And so just beneath the surface, we see the sovereign hand of God bringing about events, making things happen at work in people's lives. But we don't always see it. This verse begins a long series of things that just happen to occur. So with those with eyes to see, we see that God is at work even still. And we see already that this is not by chance. There's four elements in this verse, this one verse, where we see God is graciously at work in Naomi's life, drawing her home. We see that it was a gift of God that in the midst of her grief and pain, Naomi is even able to hear good news. Often when we're grieving and hurting, we're just so, you know, blocked off, blinded to good news. We're unable to hear grace. We're unable to hear good news. But God has opened her ears, and she's able to hear good news and respond. We also see that the Lord has visited his people, and this has a rich meaning, this word. It means that Yahweh, God, has intervened on behalf of, he's come to the aid of his people. God is acting in covenant faithfulness to his people here. This is good news. It tells us that the people have likely repented and returned to him, given our theology and context with the book of Judges that we talked about last week. We also see that he has visited his people. Even though that they have rejected God, He is, and they've, you know, they've been committing themselves to worshiping Baal and Chemosh and a million other stumps of wood, but he is still sees them as his people. God still considers them his covenant people and is faithful to them when they've been unfaithful to him. We see that God is still faithful to his people. And the fourthly, we also see that he has given them food. He's given bread to Bethlehem, because the problem for the last decade in the first four verses was this famine in Bethlehem. And there's a play on words here because, you know, our versions say food, but the Hebrew word is bread. It's the same word. It can speak specifically of bread or it can speak generically of food. So the text means food, but it's saying bread. The house of bread, Bethlehem, the house of bread is being restocked. Breadland has bread again. So God is working in these subtle ways, gracious, providential ways to draw Naomi home. And so she begins the long and humbling journey back to Bethlehem in verse 7. Take a look. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. So Naomi's heading home, but is this the right move for Ruth and Orpah? Bethlehem's her home. It's not their home. They're leaving home. They're going to a foreign country. And they will be, and we have to really emphasize this and feel this, they will be unwelcome foreigners of a different race in Israel. Moab and Israel have an ugly past. Like, there's a history of violence and conflict. And so these Moabite women are not likely to be welcomed. And that's a pretty important thing to keep in mind for Ruth and Orpah as they head back as widows dependent on the generosity of others. Right? It may be hard for those of us who are white Canadians to imagine that you have to consider hostility because of your race when choosing where you're going to live. And that's a real factor for you as you decide, should I move to this city or to this country or to this place? Is it going to be safe for me? I mean, that's not a question that many of us ever think of, but for many people in the world, that is something they're thinking of, and that ought to be something that Ruth and Orpah think of, because is Bethlehem a safe place for Moabite widows? Hard to say. It's hard to say. And so there's not a lot of hope for them to go with Naomi to Israel. And in order to understand what's happening in Naomi's language here and what's going on and what we're going to see in the following verses is you have to understand this thing called Levirate marriage, which is kind of weird to us, but it's part of their society. When an Israelite husband dies without a son, without any heirs, his unmarried brother or near relative was to marry the widow and preserve the brother's name. The children would officially carry the name of the dead husband. And so this is weird, right? This is a strange practice. However, in a culture where your name and your heritage are really important, in a culture, you know, in the tribe's existence really matters, in a culture where widows are really vulnerable, in a culture where one's security is very much connected to the land that's been passed on through their family line, this practice is actually an important and helpful way to protect those who have been left as widows. And so Ruth and Orpah, though Moabites in an Israelite family, seem to be familiar with this Hebrew practice, and they may feel obligated. They have to stick with Naomi's family to protect the line in the future. Otherwise, this family is going to get wiped out forever. And this family is on the brink of extinction, hanging in the balance. But Naomi urges them, no, look, there's no relative to redeem them. There's no one here that can marry them. It's ridiculous for you to think that I can produce more sons for you and that you have an obligation to stick with me. Just go back to Moab. You have better chances in Moab. By sending them to their mother's house, that language is always connected to remarriage. If they're back in their mother's house, she's releasing them to remarry. And their commitment to Naomi, to Naomi's dead sons, is complete. They have fulfilled their obligations faithfully and wonderfully. You are free to return, free to remarry. You can still build a life. You're young enough that you can start again. This is Naomi showing sort of tough love. They feel compelled to stick with her, and she knows they have no future with her. They're better off back with their families, back in Moab, while she goes it alone. And so she's firm and tender with them and commands them, blesses them, cries with them. And at this point in verse 8, we're introduced to an important, really important word tied to the theme of the book of Ruth. It's the Hebrew word chesed. The ESV translates it kindly, that you've acted kindly. That may the Lord deal kindly with you. Chesed. There's no single English word that captures what this word is being communicated in Hebrew. Old Testament scholar Dan Block says, it is a covenant term, wrapping up in itself all the positive attributes of God: love, covenant faithfulness, mercy, grace, kindness, loyalty. In short, it refers to acts of devotion and loving kindness that go beyond the requirements of duty. Naomi calls on God to show his covenant love, his loving kindness, sometimes it gets translated in English, this faithful, loyal, gracious, pursuing love, that God would show that love to her daughters-in-law, just as they have shown those sorts of attributes to her and to her sons, even though they're Moabites. In the book of Ruth, we're going to see several characters putting on display, demonstrating chesed, God's covenant love. And we see pictures of what God is like through the acts of grace and mercy and kindness and faithfulness and loyalty of certain individuals. But Naomi sends them away while they insist on staying with her. Take a look at how it happens. Verse 11. But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So in response, Naomi insists that they return home. She's very insistent. She gives three reasons why they need to go home. They have no hope if they align their future with her. She says, "I can't produce a husband for you, right? Don't align yourself with me. I have no more sons, and they're not coming. There's no more coming either." And Naomi rightly assumes that Ruth and Orpah are hoping to remarry, but what she's saying is, don't stick with me. I don't have sons. You have way better chances. Your chance for prosperity and a future and security lay in Moab, not with me. Secondly, she says, I'm too old to remarry. So I don't have sons, and I can't get sons, right? She's probably at least 50 years old at this point, which is extremely young, of course. Totally. But in those days, a very different time, in the ancient Near East, she's a senior citizen in a time when people did not live as long and look as amazing at 50 as they do now. But even if she did remarry, and if she could have more children, highly unlikely, probably not biologically possible, would Ruth and Orpah seriously wait till those sons were grown? Would they resist remarrying for the next two decades? Right? It's just not likely. She's just saying, you know, these women, Ruth and Orpah, are probably about 30 years old at this point. They'd have to wait, you know, another 20 years. And they themselves would be beyond childbearing years at that point. It's just crazy for them to place any hope in Naomi. She's like, I have nothing to offer you when it comes to your future security and marriage and things like that. And thirdly, this is the big one, I think. She says, I'm much too bitter for you, since the Lord's hand has gone out against me. Naomi feels like she is the target of God's overwhelming power. God is against her. So you would be foolish to align with me. If you stick with me, God may be against you as well. And instead of repenting of her sin, of her own sin, instead of seeking God's favor, she accuses God of injustice towards her. She believes that God is acting wrongly against her, and so you want to stay away from me, lest you too come under the hand of God's injustice. Wow, pretty harsh words. You don't want to stick with me because God's not on my team. No, he's not on my side. Verse 14. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Interesting, the word clung is the same word that's used in Genesis 2:24 when Adam clings to his wife. And so it's a word about covenant commitment and sticking together. And Ruth expresses that, acts that out towards Naomi. Now, to return to Moab is not just to return to a patch of dirt and earth, but is to return to the Moabite people and to return to the Moabite theology, to return to the Moabite gods. As Naomi said, go with Orpah to her gods. And for Orpah to return to Moab is to return to Chemosh, the patron god of the Moabites. For Naomi to urge Ruth to go back to her gods as Orpah has done reveals a very careless attitude about God. According to Naomi, it really doesn't matter at this point. It doesn't matter who you worship. It would be better for Ruth to align with the gods of Moab than it would for her to align with Yahweh, the God of Israel. This is a really troubling attitude from Naomi. Is this the depth of her faith? That all gods are essentially the same. And you know what? My God doesn't seem to like me, so you don't really have a future with him. And it doesn't really matter what you believe. You'd probably be better off with Chemosh, the god that you sacrifice the babies to. I mean, Chemosh is a wicked dude. It's not an attractive religion. They threw their babies into the fires to appease Chemosh. But you'd be better off with Chemosh than you would with Yahweh. And having been told for the fourth time to go back to Moab and watching Orpah walk away in the distance, Ruth was faced with a tough decision. Would she choose her own people, her ethnic people? Would she choose to go back to the Moabites and their god Chemosh? Or would she cast her lot in with her aging mother-in-law and move to a strange land and place her hope in Yahweh, the God of Israel? It's a decision she's facing, and it's not a small one. And here's what she says, these amazing and beautiful and profound words. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." Whew. Wow. This is a powerful declaration of loyalty and hope. And she's saying, stop pressuring me to leave you, to abandon or forsake you. You could put those synonyms in there as well. It's very emphatic. Stop it. No more. I'm not leaving. Right? I'm committed to going wherever you go and living wherever you live. Second, I'm committed to dying where you die. Like, there's not a lot of hope. I know there's not a lot of hope, but when you die and I die, we're going to die together, to being buried where you're buried. Even after you die and I remain, I won't return to Moab even then. Even then, I will be buried where you are buried. And the third part, which is actually the middle part, but in the Hebrew poem, it's a chiasm, and so the center part is the emphatic part. And so I switched the order. In the emphatic part, the fulcrum on which the whole poem hinges is, your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Ruth is committing herself not only to Naomi, but to Naomi's people, right? Ruth, the foreigner, will align herself with the people of Israel. She'll leave her people, adopt a new people. It's a conversion story. She's abandoning Moab and adopting Israel as her home and her people, a land she's never seen, a people she does not know, apart from bitter Naomi and dead Mahlon and Chilion. Ruth is also committing herself to Naomi's God, Yahweh. She's throwing her lot in with God. What Ruth has seen in Naomi that has attracted her to Yahweh, I do not know, because I don't see it. Naomi is not portraying a vivid, robust faith that ought to be emulated. I don't know what she has seen or what she knows about God, but apparently Ruth has seen enough to know that God, the God of Israel, is the sovereign God, and she will place her hope and faith in him come what may. And the final part of her declaration is actually an oath to Yahweh. May God turn against me if I turn away from you. May I go to my death if anything but death separates us. Like, it's a very powerful oath. It's an all-in life or death oath. These are powerful words. Powerful. So powerful is Ruth's covenant commitment to Naomi that often people use these as words, as wedding vows, which in some ways is appropriate because it's marriage is no less a covenant commitment than what Ruth is swearing here, right? That no matter what happens, till death, I'm all in with you. On the other hand, it's a little bit strange because this is an oath to her mother-in-law, not to a wife or husband. But it's a powerful words of commitment. I have a hard time imagining saying them to my mother-in-law, and she's lovely. It's just great. I don't know. This is a significant thing she's doing. So what do you say in response to such a loving, deep, powerful statement of commitment? How would you respond if someone said this to you? Verse 18, and when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. In response to this passionate, powerful, poetic proclamation of commitment and loyalty, Naomi says nothing. There's no thank you. There's no I love you. There's no joy. There's no gratitude. Like the music rises. They hug it out. Like, I get the sense it's just sort of like, okay, I guess I'm stuck with you. Isn't it amazing that Naomi says nothing? I mean, our response is to cross-stitch these words and hang them on the wall or recite them at our wedding. The words are so powerful, and they amaze us, right? But Naomi says nothing. Why? I think we're going to see in the next verses what's going on in her heart that would lead her to not rejoice at this, but to do nothing. So take a look at what's going on in her head. We get a little more insight into her in verse 19. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem, and when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? She said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? The whole town was stirred. They were buzzing. They were talking and gossiping, and everyone was talking about Naomi, and the people are buzzing about her appearance. And it's kind of there's a double meaning here. Appearance in the sense of showing up unexpectedly after 10 plus years. Like, oh, she appeared suddenly. Like, we didn't see this coming. But it also means appearance like physical looks. They're buzzing about her appearance because people hardly recognize her, right? Naomi, the name Naomi, the word, it means sweet or pleasant or the pleasant one. She left Israel as a robust, beautiful woman in her prime with a husband, two sons, and a bright future. And she's returned, and they hardly recognize her. She's haggard and old and destitute and is left without security or a future. She left with so much and is returned so empty. She used to be the woman that everyone wanted to be, and now she is the one that they all pity. And so she's become the talk of a town. They're buzzing about her appearance in both senses. So Naomi publicly changes her name. She's no longer the pleasant one. That's just a bad name for me. She is now Mara, bitter. You can't call such a suffering woman by such a sweet and pleasant name. Call me bitter, because that's what I am. And she levels four accusations against God. One, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. He has dealt bitterly with me. Secondly, I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. He emptied me. Third, the Lord has testified against me. This is sort of a courtroom image, and God is a prosecutor bringing charges. He's not my defender. He's the prosecutor on the other side. He's testifying against me. He's accusing me. He's working to my detriment. And fourthly, the Almighty has brought calamity upon me. Here's a question. This is what the narrator's leaving for us to ponder. Is Naomi right to blame her situation on God? Is this the right response or a wrong response? I would say she's right to admit the sovereignty of God in her hard situation. God did not lose control when her husband died and her sons died. He didn't mess up. His hands weren't tied. He is sovereign. He's still sovereign, and he's still in control. But she is so bitter and so hardened that she exaggerates her agony, and she's blinded to the hope of the grace of God. In her mind, God is sovereign, but he's not good. He's sovereign, but he's not good. And this leads to bitterness. If you view God as sovereign but not good, you'll end up bitter, angry, mad at God. The opposite error can be, we can make the opposite mistake where we say that God is good, but he's not sovereign, right? He's not involved in the hard situations of life. This naturally leads us to despair because my suffering has no purpose. There's no hope. I have no rock to stand on. God can't stop it. God can't do anything. He's not sovereign. It's out of his hands, right? These things just happen, and there's no purpose to them. There's no end goal. There's no good that could be accomplished. He's good, but he's not doing anything here. He's just not involved. And so there's these two opposite errors that we can make. Naomi has fallen into the one. She sees God as sovereign, rightly, but she's exaggerated his activity and its evil intents. Like, she's assigned blame and evil to him in his actions, and she doesn't see his goodness at all. Doesn't see his goodness. And so it may seem as if evil is out of control, but God is still working according to his will. He's actively accomplishing his good, global, far-reaching purposes, even through horrible and dark situations. Naomi is right to see God's hand of providence ultimately behind her painful situations, but she's wrong to see it, to see God as vindictive or harsh or accusatory. Naomi sees God's providence, but she doesn't see his goodness. Here's another question for us as we wrestle with Naomi here. Is Naomi repentant? Is she repentant? We see she's returning to the lands, but is her heart returning to God? Does she regret taking shortcuts from God and wandering into the fields of compromise? She gives, in my view, she gives no indication of repentance. Instead, she's filled with bitterness. She's not repentant. She feels like God has wronged her and owes her better. Her body has made its way home, but her heart is still running from God's sovereign grace. So we're left a little bit unsure what to think of Naomi at this point. Some readers actually see Naomi as a hero to be emulated. She returned. Good for her. Let's follow her example. Let's return. Others don't see any redeeming qualities in her. Ruth acts heroically. Naomi doesn't. Now, it might be easy to skip over verse 22. It's just summarizing things, right? But no. That would be a big mistake. There's some great truths given in subtle ways here in verse 22. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. It's very emphatic. Ruth is from Moab. Ruth is from Moab. She's a Moabite from Moab. It's very emphatic. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Firstly, I like how the narrator, okay, Naomi insists, don't call me Naomi anymore, pleasant. Call me Mara. I'm bitter. God has acted bitterly towards me, and I'm bitter. But I love how the narrator doesn't obey. The narrator never calls her Mara. He insists on still calling her Naomi. Naomi believes her situation is hopeless and her future is bitter. The narrator knows something more. The narrator sees how this bitter providence will turn sweet once again. He insists on calling the bitter woman pleasant, even when she isn't acting the part. Naomi's given up. The narrator hasn't. The narrator hasn't. I love it emphasizes as well that Ruth, this is actually the first time it explicitly says that Ruth is a Moabite. We knew that because she was from Moab, you know, in verses like 4. They took Moabite wives, it says. But here it really emphasizes now. She's a Moabite from Moab, and she's coming to Israel. It's highlighting the potential conflict here. And then it tells us that this all happened at the beginning of the barley harvest. They have arrived at the house of bread just as the grain for bread is ready to be cut, usually about late April, Barley is the first crop to be harvested, so this is just the beginning. But the author is doing so much more than just telling us what month it is. The ripening grain is a picture of the brilliant and glorious light of God's grace that is peeking through the dark clouds of Naomi's pain and suffering. God is about to do something big. And so there is hope. There is hope for Naomi and for Ruth, because this is just the beginning of the barley harvest. Hold on, more is coming. O pleasant one, you will see his goodness still. What can we conclude from this story? What do we draw from this? Okay, first from Naomi. Let's look at Naomi first. From Naomi, we are warned of the blinding power of bitterness. Naomi rightly recognizes that God is sovereign. He's in control. But she no longer believes that God is good. Embittered by her pain and her loss and her hardship, she blames God and does not believe that God is good to her. Her bitterness brings out complaining instead of trust. One author, Ian Duguid, writes, "Like Naomi, we may be so busy complaining about our emptiness that we miss the fact that God has emptied our hands in order to fill them with something so much better." But in her complaining, Naomi is not able to trust that God is working good. Can't trust him. She's unable to see the gifts of grace that God is already working in her life. And there's going to be many more coming. The rest of the book is about the filling of empty Naomi. In the fields of Moab, Naomi hears good news from back home. What a gift of grace. She learns that the Lord has visited his people. What a gift. He is acting in covenant love towards them. That there is food again in the house of bread. What a gift of grace. She doesn't see it. She's so bitter to God that she even urges her daughters-in-law to abandon God and return to their Moabite gods. The blessing does not lie with Yahweh, my daughters. You'd be better off with Chemosh of the Moabites. So bitter. Meanwhile, she still does not see God's greatest gift to her and the one through whom her redemption will ultimately come. Who's that? What is that? That seemingly unwanted Moabite daughter-in-law, that appendage that won't leave her alone, that extra mouth to feed. At this point, I think Naomi sees Ruth as a hassle to get rid of. But it turns out she is the greatest gift of God's grace to her so far and will be the one through whom Naomi's redemption will come. She thinks that she has no hope, and she thinks that this Moabite needs to go away when she is the hope and the one through whom God will work abundantly in her life. As we will see, Ruth is not a liability. She is a grace to Naomi. But in her bitterness, she just can't see it. And so even when Ruth says, "I'm with you till death and beyond," Naomi has nothing to say about that. She just gives up. In the face of Ruth's courage and commitment and faith, Naomi just is silent. She has nothing to say. She just gives up her attempts to send pesky Ruth away. But at the end of the book, in chapter 4, verse 15, after Ruth and Boaz's wedding, oh, I spoiled the ending, and the birth of Naomi's grandchild, it gets happy, seriously. But at the very end of the book, the women of Bethlehem say this, chapter 4, verse 15. The women of Bethlehem, the ones who in our text right now are going, "Is this Naomi?" Like, they're surprised at her appearance. She looks awful. "Is this Naomi?" The same women now say to Naomi, "For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons." Wow. In that culture, that your daughter-in-law, the pesky Moabite daughter-in-law, is more valuable to you than seven sons. Ruth is a gift. And in time, God will show Naomi what a gift she is. But in her bitterness, Naomi can't see it. She's blinded to God's grace. Here's the question for us. Please hear this and wrestle with this question. Will the hard, painful providences of God, those seasons of pain and loss, those difficult situations, will they lead you to overwhelming bitterness? Will you miss seeing his grace in the hard seasons? Will you have eyes to see? please have eyes to see God's grace towards you. Don't be overwhelmed with bitterness like Naomi. So, from Naomi, we are warned of the blinding power of bitterness through God's hard providences. From Ruth, we see how God draws outsiders to himself. We are all outsiders, like Orpah and Ruth. We are Moabites, born far from God's people and far from his promises. We are Ruth, right? And sometimes we, like Orpah, are tempted to take the path of self-interest and prosperity, right? Orpah, she likes Naomi. She wants to stick with Naomi and be loyal to Naomi. But she uses her head and she does the smart thing. She returns to her home where there's a better prospect for prosperity and security and a future. Logic. She uses logic. She goes, I know I should be loyal to Naomi. I probably should go to Israel with Naomi and with Ruth. But it's true, if I go back to my home and if I marry a Moabite man and if I worship Chemosh, I'll probably have a better chance if I go that way. Like, it logically makes sense. My best prospect for prosperity and security rests in Moab. So that's what she does. She uses her head. Will we use our head, allegedly, and choose the path of self-interest and seeking prosperity? Or will we, like Ruth, go all in with God and choose the path of courage and commitment and faith? Will we go all in with God and with his people, come what may, like Ruth does? In chapter 2, verse 12, we're told a little bit more about the motive and the heart of what Ruth is doing in pledging commitment to Naomi and to God. Boaz pronounces this blessing on Ruth, and it kind of explains what's going on in the background a bit. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel. Listen to this. Under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Instead of taking refuge in Moab and with Chemosh, Ruth the Moabite is taking refuge under the wings of God. In this bitter providence, in this hard providence, in these difficult days, where will Ruth find security? Ruth, with courage and commitment and faith, sees Yahweh as her security and her safety, her hope and her future. A bleak and uncertain future as an impoverished immigrant widow doesn't lead Ruth to bitterness, doubt, or fear, but instead, turning her eyes to God, she moves forward with courage, commitment, and faith. And God is drawing her in. And so we too are outsiders like Ruth. We're outsiders like Ruth. Think of Ephesians 2. I love this passage. This is Ruth's story, this is your story and my story. Remember that you Gentiles were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenant of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one, and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. And he came and preached peace to you who are far off and peace to those who are near, for through him we both have access in one spirit to the Father. So then, you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and with the members of the household of God. We, like Ruth, were far off, but by the blood of the cross, God has brought us near, and we are saints and citizens. We are family. We belong to the household of God. We are Ruth, those far off, brought near by his grace. So let's seek refuge under the wings of God. It may even be through hard providences and painful situations that God is bringing us to himself, emptying our hands of many things in order to fill them with something better, namely himself. And let's live with courage and commitment and faith like Ruth, even in the hardest, darkest, and most painful of days. when it feels like going all in with God is hopeless, go all in with God and watch Him fill what is empty with Himself.